produced by Jeffrey Cresselius, Preston Frazier, Bill Govier, VR Hoisington, and Wayne Hall. This is Yes Music Podcast episode 381. James W. Cushing from the amazing YouTube channel Yes Source.
This is Bill Bruford, the ever-enthusiastic young drummer from the group Yes, and you're listening to the Yes Music Podcast.
Welcome to episode 381 of the Yes Music Podcast, two fans' exploration of the world's greatest progressive rock band. I'm your host, Kevin Mulrine, and co-host Mark Anthony Kay will be along a little bit later on. You can always get involved with the podcast, and please do, via the various different ways on the site, yesmusicpodcast.com. Mark and I had a very enjoyable conversation this week with Jim Cushing about his Yes blog and YouTube channel. He's collected together an amazing collection of rare Yes ephemera for your delectation, and he's a lovely guy as well. Listen to the whole of our interview in a few moments. This week on social media, it was a slightly quieter week than usual, but dates and booking details are out now for some of the Royal Affair tour, so if you can get to one of those concerts, you're bound to be in good company. Billy Sherwood and Alan White have been posting about their individual rehearsals, and there are plenty of hints at unusual songs being prepared. Daniel Crone posted his views on another Yes Live album, and Roger Dean's official page added shots of him allegedly working on the painting, which is being used for the front cover of the forthcoming Yes 50 Live album. Preston Frazier received his copies of 1,000 Hands, finally, and Miguel Falcao is still promoting the Play for Chris 5 project. You have until the end of May to get your video to him, which reminds me I need to get practicing. Bob Keeley has been musing about Steve Hackett and Yes, having very few hits they feel they need to play at every live show. And Jeffrey Mason and Brady Queen added a link to a collection of 80s power ballads, which includes If Only You Knew from The Ladder. Patrick Gannon was impressed with Yes alumnus Tom Brislin playing with Kansas, and Jeffrey was back with an in-depth interview with Bill Bruford. Adrian Bell's Progressive Alternative Show has hit the airwaves with episode 106, and there was a Yes-related act on Britain's Got Talent, the UK TV show, this week, but I'm afraid it all passed me by completely. If you knew what that was all about, please tell us. There was also news of Elisa Fur and her all-star band, which includes Jay Shellen, Billy Sherwood, and others. They're doing a tour playing Celine Dion songs. And the questions have been posed. Is this what Yes members should be doing? Is this great as you get to see your Yes heroes once again, or a dumbing down of a great band? I'm keen to have your views on that. Kenny Brown has been listening to One Live Badger, and Doug Curran fed back some interesting views from his friendship with Peter Banks on last week's show notes. Do go and take a look at that. Nick Moyart sent a pre-release link to the Yes 50 Live collection, and Adrian Fitzgerald sent a voicemail.
I'm a bit of a Yes fan, and I'm not sure if you guys knew that Trevor Rabin made an LP called, in 1978, the band was called the TCs, and the title was Disco Love Boy. It came out on DGM Records, and you can get it on eBay. Thank you for your show.
So thank you to everyone who got in touch in any way this week.
Hello, this is Patrick Moraz, and you are listening to the Yes Music Podcast.
So someone that you may not have heard the name of, but you may well know about his activities online to do with Yes, is Jim Cushing. And he's here with Mark and I now. So hello, Jim.
Hi, guys. Pleasure to be on. Thank you for asking me.
So hi, Jim. How are you doing there?
Good, thanks. Probably the first sunny day in a week here in Philadelphia. So,
I know the feeling because I'm just having the first sunny day here too in a very long time. So let's start things off on a positive sunny thing. I know John Anderson would approve. So we all have had our own Yes story. So when, where, how, and why did, or how did Yes start with you?
Well, it's funny. I'm in my 40s, so I was in junior high school back in 1988. I was sixth grade. I'm a Christian. I'm an Anglican, actually, for your British listeners, Anglican Church in North America. And at the time, I was going to Christian school, and they weren't too hip on the secular rock and roll, even at the late 80s. And so I was talking with some friends in study hall or something or other, and this kid called Andrew Cox was going on and on and on about how he liked this band U2, which is ironically a Christian band probably nowadays. And these two other guys who I was friends with Tim and Bill Frazier. He said, I really like this band Petra because their covers are cool and they have guitars in the shape of spaceships and all kinds of cool stuff. And I said, all right, so I'll pick up a couple of Petra albums because I really wasn't into music at all. I was, 12 and just getting into it. And so I got a couple of Petra albums. And just at that time, back in like 86, or just a couple years before this, Petra got involved with the Elefante brothers. I don't know if you, John and Dino Elefante, I don't know if you know who they are. They, for progressive rock people, they were got involved with Kansas. They were, John, I think, was a singer for Kansas for a while. And so Petra was sort of getting influenced by this sort of Kansas guy. The guys are going to become Kansas. And so at that time, they were sort of, I guess, entering into that sort of mode of playing, which they were already doing in 85. They came with Beat the System, kind of concept album. And I really liked that. And so Petra was like my band for a long time. I really liked them. I was very obsessed with them. And my uncle at the time, my uncle Jim, actually, he said, hey, if you like these guys, you might like Boston. And I thought Boston, he gave me the first Boston album, which I thought was the greatest album. And I played that to death on a cassette. Yeah. And then his wife, my aunt at the time, they're not together anymore, Donna, she said she was a Yes fan. And she said, you know what, if you like Boston with the high singing and the guitars and all that, you'll really like Yes. And so she gave me a cassette of Yes songs. And I put that on and I thought, this is the greatest thing I've ever heard. This is what I've been waiting for. This is like probably 1991 when I was in ninth grade. I thought, this is the best album I ever heard, because my dad's a classical music person. And I thought, well, this has all the sophistication that my dad likes.
Yeah.
But it has like the hard edge, cool stuff of and the energy of rock. This is the best thing I ever heard. And then I played that to death. And she gave me 90125 and Classic Yes.
Yeah.
Right after that. And then that sort of started the obsession with Yes and then prog rock in general. And I, sort of explored and gone to concerts and festivals and bought it up after that. But that was sort of like, probably 91 with the Yes songs was what kicked it off. Was like, this is where I want to be in terms of music.
Yeah. I'm interested though. I mean, you started with Yes songs, that classic material, and then the next thing was 90125. Yeah. Can you remember what you thought?
Well, I don't know. I was young and just sort of like, okay, this is the other album that they made. I would say 90125 was closer to what I was listening to with Petra, right? That's sort of like that style that they had. So I was sort of, but Yes songs had an allure to me because there was just so much going on in that album and so raw. And when she gave me Classic Yes, which is essentially Yes songs, but studio, I thought that sort of that became more of an interest to me than 90125.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's talk about your online activities then, because that's how most of our listeners can get to know you after this episode. And you've created a large number of Yes resources on the web, and that includes your blog. But just before we talk about the Yes stuff on your blog, there's an awful lot more than stuff about Yes on there, isn't there?
Yeah. Well, I'm a lawyer, right? So I hope you don't hold that against me. In Philadelphia, no less, right? We have a reputation, I guess. And this is also hometown Philadelphia for Yes. Yes is home away from home here in Philadelphia. And so I'm a columnist. I work for the law office of Faye Riva Cohen, and I decided to become a columnist in like local legal newspapers, the Legal Intelligencer, upon further review, the Pennsylvania Family Lawyer, and stuff like that. And at some point, I wanted to place the catalog and create a bibliography for myself. So I started a blog and would upload my articles as they were published in the newspaper. And that, honestly, it's, unless you're really reading it, it's kind of boring and dry and technical and not sort of stuff, that kind of stuff. So, and other people were getting success in writing blogs, right? Because that's the new way. That's the future is the internet, right? So you have to have an internet presence. And so I wasn't getting very many readers. And so, all right, I wanted to write, I started trying to write original material. So, at that time, this is about 7 or 8 years ago, I guess, point, Roger Dean was suing James Cameron.
Yeah.
And so I thought, okay, you know what? I'll try to attract some music people into reading my blog by writing about Dean versus Cameron.
Mm-hmm.
So I wrote a variety of posts and uploaded all of the legal documents in those cases. I actually did another podcast a number of years ago with a patent lawyer called Anthony Verna, the Law and Business Podcast, all about why that case wound up the way it did. And because unfortunately our guy Roger did not win that case.
Yeah.
And so that sort of launched me writing and posting other things. I write about theology because like I said, I'm a Christian, so I like that. And I write about music. And unfortunately for my legal career, the Roger Dean stuff got the biggest hits in my blog. which was not the intention of my blog, but it is what it is. And so I thought, you know what, I'll just start writing about music and maybe people will read my legal writing while they're there. I'm not sure if that's really happened, but, and so I've been to a ton of Yes concerts and a ton of other prog rock concerts. I went to every single Near Fest except for the first one, Northeastern Art Rock Festival. And so I started uploading pictures and reviews and the tour books and the t-shirts and the ticket stubs, and just sort of as a way of like increasing the Yes stuff out there on the web. Mm. And at some point I started running out of material, and I thought, you know what? I got 150 gigs worth of Esoteria that I could put up on YouTube. And that's what inspired my YouTube channel. Like, it's just sitting there doing nothing.
Right.
Might as well put it out there.
You also have a great Yes YouTube channel. What do you concentrate on there?
Well, I'm just putting up my collections. So, and so the way I know there's some people out there that just like hoard and hoard all these concerts, and I don't know, that really wasn't interesting to me. So my focus is, when it comes to live material, I don't know how best to explain it, but I want to have a copy of every song that Yes has done on every tour, or at least one. I don't need to have 10 shows from every tour. That seems repetitive, but because some people do that, right? There's a couple of websites out there like that, but I like to have one complete show, at least one complete show, and then a version of every song that they played if they rotated the set list from time to time. Hmm. So that's sort of my goal. And then it sort of parlayed into, well, there's other stuff out there like studio sessions and rehearsals and singles and B-sides, and it sort of grew out from that. And you know, I come from a hoarding family, right? So I'm very good at like collecting things. My wife, who's a clinical therapist, says I have obsessive compulsive personality disorder. So I'm very organized in my hoarding. And so I had a very well organized and curated like collection here, and I sort of putting it up one by one in chronological order so I can keep track of it all.
Excellent. Well, how far have you got?
I am just finishing 2011 this week.
Ah,
wow.
And then once I'm finished my main collection, I think I'm going to go back and do you know, I have a variety of things from when Yes is before they were in Yes. So like with Neat Change and Happy Magazine and different things like that.
Fantastic. So you've collected all these up to 2011 and put them all on the web for us to all enjoy. But what are your favorite eras? What are the eras that when you've been collecting and uploading, you've thought this is the best stuff?
Well, you know, I guess I'm just a stereotypical Yes fan. I really like the classic, I guess Bill Martin called it the main sequence, right? Mm. So I really like the main sequence of Yes, you know, the Yes album to Going for the One is probably the best. But what I will say is, and it's probably, I don't know how Yes fans like this, but probably since Fly From Here, you know, like 7 or 8, 9 years now, I guess, or 8 years, whenever I put on Yes, I tend to listen to things from the 90s onward, because I don't know, I've played the 70s stuff so much that it's basically background now. So I like the new, the 80s never really got to me. I mean, I appreciate it. I don't denigrate it. Yes West is what it was, but I don't listen to it that much. But when it comes to Yes, when I put on Yes, I put on stuff like from, I would say, well, even Talk Onward is my go-to Yes stuff now, because I feel like it's very underplayed in concert, and it's sort of the way Yes is now. So I enjoy that.
What was your take on Fly From Here, Return Trip?
I was a vanity project, I thought. Not that I didn't appreciate it, but I thought it was sort of a vanity project. But I think it was something that I think it fits well into the catalog as Drama Part Two, and I think that's what the fans really were hoping for when it first came out. They sort of tempted it, right? Because Trevor Horn was in there producing it. So, and I think that in terms of the two different Fly From Here, the suite itself, in my opinion, I think they both there's differences between the two, and I think that the best Fly From Here has elements of both. I think certain things they did on the new one are a little better, but I think it sort of lacks some of the cool stuff on the other one. So if I were to do it over, I'd combine elements of the two. The missing track, the one that they added for Return Trip, was, I don't know, it was very like a Steve Howe song, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
Not a bad thing, but it sounded more like an Asia song than a Yes song.
Don't take no for an answer, wasn't it? Yeah,
yeah.
I just looked it up.
Yeah. excellent. Yeah, it's sort of like an Asia song to me. I'm not that I'm not going to take it. It's the most recent Yes song that they've made, so
yes,
I'll take it. But yeah, I really thought Fly From Here was a great album. I really, really enjoyed that. Mm-hmm. And in fact, my kids, who are 6 and 10, that's their favorite Yes album. That's the one they always ask for some reason. So
cool. Interesting.
Well, it has that really cool beginning, right? That has like the quiet and then the loud and then the singable chorus. So it works.
So I'm very curious to hear your answer about this question. So what would you say are the most surprising Yes items you have come across and added to your online collection?
You know, I thought about that question after I got it from you. And I would say, to me, I am really surprised about how many videos are available from the 60s and early 70s. I was really shocked at that. I mean, in fact, one was just sort of unearthed recently in the last year or so of Yes playing a show, I want to say in Belgium, video material of them playing. Oh, no. It was Wiesbaden. Sorry.
Yeah.
And it was complete concert footage from like 1969. I mean, the Yes is barely a year old at that point. And they have actual footage, and I find it fascinating because, you know, you don't get to see much of Peter Banks. There's stuff even older than that, like with John Anderson with the Warriors from the 64. Cool stuff that people hung on to, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Anything else from later on?
Well, one of the things I really like is I like studio stuff. Mm-hmm. I find the session work really fascinating because, you know, you get to hear songs that are, you know, nascent in their creation. Or, you know, I don't know if you remember, but when Steve Wilson did Fragile, he did there's a track he put out there called, you know, All Fighters Pass.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff is really cool to me because you have like essentially a topographic song played with Fragile sounds with close to the edge keyboard parts. You know what I mean? And that's so neat to me because obviously these ideas are floating around and it shows you how they're thinking and working.
I'm curious. These videos that you come across, are these stuff that you find through auctions, or is this more like a hunt through private sellers?
Oh, my collection was developed a variety of ways. When I was in high school, I discovered the bootleg when I was in high school. You know, and of course back then, you know, I've seen the beginning of videotapes, right? I don't want the FBI warnings. I was kind of like afraid that I'm going to get some raid in my bedroom, you know, whatever. But I went to a record store in Northeast Philadelphia called Rainbow Records, which I don't think is there anymore. And but someone told me I should go because it's like an independent store. And I saw these Yes albums. And at the time, you know, I don't know if you remember if you had this in Britain, but like I used to go to The Wall or the Sam Goody, you know. And at the time, they had that little computer screen, which was high tech, I guess, and come out with that little receipt tape that had like all the albums of your, you know, you printed your favorite band in, and it would come out and have all the albums that they made that they could sell.
Right.
And I was looking for those. I was ticking them off as I go, and I was at Rainbow Records, and I saw albums for Yes, and I'm like, wow, the Wall doesn't have any of these, and neither does Sam Goody. And my naivete, I thought, I found something here, and I got them home, and I'm like, you know, what are these? And I realized that people have made CDs that are, you know, of their own creation with their own name. Like, I got the White Album. I don't know if you ever heard of that. It's like a bootleg
from. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And I got another one called Close to the Edge, but it was like, You Were a Liar Show.
Yeah.
Right, so,
there's some interesting bootlegs like that.
Yeah, yeah. And that's, so at that point, I was in college not long after that, and these independent record shops, I started scouring those places, and they'd come and sell their wares at my college, my university, and I'd buy these sorts of things. And then at some point the internet happened, opened up a whole, like, you know, world of esoteria. You could just download. I tried to find the esoteric, never did, only parts of it. But you know, and that's sort of how it happened. And now the internet has been such a huge source of, and YouTube, a huge source of material. That's great. I mean, there's a Yes website out there that I go to all the time because he updates it monthly. The yessongs.nl. It's just a great website.
Yeah.
And I love that website.
Cool.
So I got to ask before we move on this, what would you say is your favorite bootleg?
Wow, that's a great question. It's hard to know because I've collected so much stuff now, but probably my favorite one was this one called Close to the Edge, like I said, from 19, and it has a show from Relayer from 1974. And I think it was, the picture on the album was the Crystal Palace. I think they were playing in Boston.
Yeah.
And that's a great bootleg. And my other bootleg that I really like is there's a one from, I think it's Jackson City. Is that what it's called? Or Jackson. Mississippi. I think that's where it is. I make geography people are going to kill me. I think it's from June 76 in Jackson. But it's basically a concert that had all of the solo albums that they were doing at the time.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And that to me is a great show because they didn't. They only did that for like, I don't know, a couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not even.
Yeah.
And that's a really good complete show of a solo album tour show where they did, you know, they did Elias, they did what do you call it, the Thought Fly, Fish Out of Water. They did Beginnings.
Mm-hmm.
They did Ramshackled. They did a little Story of I. And the Fish Out of Water stuff is great because John Anderson's singing on it. So
yeah, brilliant. Okay, well you've covered sort of 90s and beyond, and also those bootlegs going right back and going right back to the start of the band. But what do you think of Yes in 2019?
You know, I have to say I've been to a lot of Yes concerts, 26 Yes concerts, and this recent concert set is strange to me because there's almost no distinction now between Yes and Asia. And it's very weird that they're both playing when there's like only Cara Palmer is really the difference now. And so I think Yes needs to find its independent identity as a band with Billy Sherwood, with, you know, they, you know, when they did Fly From Here and even Heaven and Earth, they had an identity. They had, you know, they had Chris, they had John, they had people. Yes has this reputation of have a rotating lineup, but if you look back, it's really not that much because probably 80% of the band has always been John, Chris, Steve, and Alan.
Mm.
And those three guys have been on practically three of those four have been on almost everything.
Mm.
And now with the loss of Chris Squire, they don't have that anymore. And so they really need to find that identity again. And now that Alan's sort of the part-time guy, it's kind of strange. So what I think they really need to do, in my opinion, is two things. One, they can't fall back into being a nostalgic band, which is what they've been doing. And I think it's really fun, the playing all these deep cuts.
Hmm.
Although Steve Howe doesn't play anything past like 1980, which is unfortunate. But I'd really like to hear some other, like even Keys to Ascension or Magnification. Those are great albums, I think.
Yeah.
But I think they can't be a nostalgia band because then you're just sort of, you're not really doing anything. And I think they really need to make a new album. I think they need to put their stamp on Yes history and give themselves an identity for Yes for the future by making a new album, coming up with a sound that's theirs, and that's what they really need to do.
Mm.
Because otherwise they're just sort of I don't know, they're just going to go into decline and become indistinguishable from Asia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think the key to them progressing is a new record. I mean, they have to do it. I mean, the good news is they are going to be doing it, which leads into the next question, which is, what are your hopes and fears for the new Yes studio album?
You know, I think with a band that's been around 20 years, much less 50 years, is that, because Yes had this problem 20 years ago, is that you have... When you have such a pedigree of albums and a reputation and a style, I think making a new album is really hard because you come out with a record and it's going to be, that doesn't sound like the Yes that I expected.
Mm.
That's the criticism. Or they make an album and it's going to be, oh, that's just Yes paint by numbers. And, oh yeah, that's what they always do. And so it seems they can't get out. It's like a weird trap. The last two albums are a perfect example of that. Fly From Here is, oh, that's just, Yes, that's retro. That's sort of Yes trying to be who they are. And then they come out with something that's completely different, whether you like it or not. Heaven and Earth is like nothing they've ever done.
Yeah.
And, that's not the Yes that I like. And so, I don't know how to get out of that conundrum, except that they need to be confident in who they are and be the band that they are today.
Mm-hmm.
And just be confident that that's going to be have enough, that they have enough talent, enough creativity that's going to be worthwhile. And I think Billy Sherwood's a good songwriter. I think John Davison's clearly a good songwriter, and Steve Howe's I don't know if he's a good songwriter, but he certainly has great guitar parts and good guitar things to add. And so I think they could do something interesting.
Well, the one thing that I think that they desperately need to do that I think that would help them is that they need to start, and I don't know how to exactly do this, but I think they need to try to get a younger fan base, because when they have such an older fan base around them, that's going to happen all the time. Oh, this is not the way. I don't like this version. I don't like that version. You can never please that. When you get a new young group of people and who don't have those expectations, they can always kind of build on it from those people. But it's difficult to do that, to get you know, somebody who's between the ages of 10 and 15 to get into a band that's 50 years old.
Yeah, and I think the problem that you have is that, you know, first of all, progressive rock is not exactly hip anymore. Or I don't know when the last time it's been hip. You know, it had like a little resurgence in 94, I guess, and then maybe in 04, but it's not really that popular. And what I think, in order to do that, in my view, and I've been to Nearfest and different things like that, is that they need to do things that they wouldn't want to do as a well-established 50-year-old band. Like Steve Howe might have too much pride to play at festivals. Mm. I think they need to go back, sort of be grassroots again and establish themselves as a new sort of happening band playing, you know, not necessarily small venues, but doing the festivals and doing the doing podcasts, yeah, and YouTubes and things of that nature that would really capture the attention of the younger people. Because, you know, I mean, I'm not exactly – I don't know where I fit in with the older young. I'm 42, so I'm younger than I'm younger than the entire band still. But John Davidson's what, like 46, so or something like that. So I guess I'm on the younger side. But even I are like I like the older stuff, and I really appreciate when they toured with Kansas and they toured with Procol Harum and they toured with Alan Parsons. That's a long time ago now, but you know, and they toured with these older groups. I really like that. I appreciate that because I want to see those groups, and I wouldn't necessarily buy tickets to Alan Parsons independently. Mm. So I get to see them with, but I think what they did with at their last Chris Squire tour, where they played with Sid Arthur, that's the kind of stuff they need to do.
Yeah, it's interesting. Just going back to the record for a second, though, how much do you think it's dependent on getting the right producer?
Mm-hmm. That's a good question. Yeah, I mean, everyone likes Trevor Horn, but one of the questions I have is, he the producer of the past or is he a producer of the future? And would a current producer really understand what they're trying to accomplish? Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, Billy Sherwood's a producer, but self-produced albums are, I don't know, they're either really good or problematic. I mean, to me, a producer only has the material to work with what the band produces, right? He's not writing. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's up to the band to come up with the material. And if they have good material, you know, I feel like it's like that story that Rick Wakeman once told when he was working with Bowie, which is, you know, David Bowie would play, he would use the most beat up, crappy guitar to come up with songs and then play them for Rick Wakeman. And then Rick would say, oh, that's a great song. And then because it's on this like crappy guitar with virtually no editing or producing or whatever, you have a nugget of something that's really good, and then you add layers to it that make it great. You know, so I think a producer can make a good product great, but I don't think they can make the band into something they're not.
But you know what, though? There's a lot of good producers out there that are good songwriters. I mean, I refer back to Robert John Mutt Lang is a great producer who's a great songwriter. Steven Wilson is a fantastic songwriter, but is a producer as well. So I think that that's actually something that they do desperately need. Because even when they had Bruce Fairburn, who did The Ladder, which I think is the best record they had done in a long time, I think still it's probably one of their best studio albums. I mean, he was a strong songwriter as well, and he guided them pretty strongly and said, no, this is garbage, work on this. This is good, let's keep that. So I think they kind of need somebody like that.
Yeah, you might be right. I mean, I don't know who that would be, though, because I don't know who the cool, I don't know who the cool producers are and who would even be willing at this point. Because I think Roy Thomas Baker was a mistake.
Yes.
I mean, it was a mistake when they tried to do it in Paris. maybe Chris Squire was trying to complete the circle or something.
Yeah, yeah, quite possibly.
But honestly, what's interesting, I mean, you know, I don't know people, I know Heaven and Earth is not exactly a well-liked album, but what's interesting is that one of the complaints about Paris was that it was really twee. And then they make Heaven and Earth, which is also kind of that way. Mm. I wonder if that's the influence of Roy Thomas Baker.
Okay, so we're coming towards the end of the time that we've got, but I would like to get your thoughts about, you've talked about the changing personnel over the years and the fact that there was this core for a long time, and clearly people like Steve Howe and Alan White and so on can't keep going forever. So do you want to see the idea that Chris Squire was keen on of the band just continually changing personnel and going on, you know, well into the future?
Well, I wonder if John Anderson is going to rejoin. He keeps making ovations at ARW. Doesn't seem to be happening.
Please don't.
I don't know. It seems really insincere to me, but I mean, I don't know. I don't have any animus toward John Anderson, but you know, his sudden interest in Steve's band is I don't know, this seems mercenary to me, but But in terms of person, I think the key to the personnel change is one, that it needs to be organic, in my opinion. So, you know, it can't be, this is the new yes and just go forward. They have to have some kind of a connective tissue with what came before. So, you know, like, you know, Jay Shellen's a great example of a guy who probably could fit right in because he has a long pedigree with the guys in Yes and Asia for that matter, which is, you know, whatever. And John Davidson's been with them for, what, like 7 years? And it was invested in an album and with the guy. So it can't be just, here's our new lineup and go. Because then there's no connective tissue. It's then you have this weird like ontological discussion as to what makes Yes, Yes. And it can't be just any collection of guys. It has to be some connection to the band, I think. And I think to me, I think the biggest question mark for Yes in terms of the perpetual future band is who's going to play guitar. I mean, that to me is the biggest question because, you know, Peter Banks is gone, obviously, but he had some claim. Trevor Rabin, I mean, he doesn't seem interested, A, and B, he just doesn't seem to be the guy. I mean, even when he was in Yes.
He's not the right one.
No, I mean, I don't want to diminish his talent, and the music that he made with Yes is interesting and good, but he never really got it, I don't think, what Steve Howe was trying to do. And I don't think he would be the guy. And so, I mean, there's Jimmy Hahn would be the, you know, he was, you know, because it's my YouTube channel, I make the rules, right? So I think that I sort of think the first Circa album is a quasi Yes album. In my opinion, I put that on my channel with Circa Live. Only the first one because it had, you know, Alan White, Billy Sherwood, Tony Kaye, and Jimmy Hahn, who played on Union. So that to me is a close enough Yes lineup. And so, but the problem with Jimmy Hahn is that I mean, I don't know enough about him, but does he have any creative juices or is he just a guy who duplicates Steve Howe? You need a guy. I mean, Yes is a very difficult band to be in because I think, and that's one of the reasons why I think Benoit David had such a problem, besides his own vocal cord problems. Is that Yes expects you to invest and be invested in a way that is more than just playing. You have to be, you know, invested in the arrangements and the writing and the creation of the music. And Jimmy Hahn, I don't know if he can do that or not. I don't know. But to me, the biggest question is who's going to play guitar? Because you can't – Steve Morse, but he's not that much younger than Steve Howe. And Steve Howe really likes him, but I don't know. I'd love to see Yes go on perpetually in the future, but it's really going to be – question. And I think it's a question of A, who plays guitar, and B, can they embrace a sound for the future? Because they can't always play close to the edge type stuff. They're going to have to do what King Crimson did back in the 00s, where in the beginning of the aughts, where they like, this is Thrak. The new band, this is what we do.
Yeah, Thrak was a great record.
Yeah, but even like the you know, the Construction of Light and Power to Believe, when you went to see King Crimson back then, they didn't play. They played like two songs from their past.
Yeah.
They were fully committed to their new identity.
Yeah.
And I think Yes, and I think Steve Howe's sort of afraid of that. Honestly, that be fully committed to a new 2019 identity. I hope he isn't, but he seems to be.
Where would you recommend listeners start with your amazing online collection?
Well, that's like saying where would you start if you're a new Yes fan. So I think first of all, I think my YouTube channel, for better or for worse, is really for the Yes fan.
Yeah.
If you're not a fan or a prog rock fan, because one of my rules for my channel, at least so far, is I have virtually nothing legitimate on there. I have a couple of things that are really rare, like Yes remixes, or like the third CD from the Ultimate Yes, where they had but other than that, and maybe some of the stuff the bonus tracks from Magnification when they did that like live album thing. But other than that, I mean, I have an intention to not, unless I start running out of material, I'm not going to put the actual Yes albums or the Yes live shows or the Yes videos up there, because you know you can go buy that from the band. This is for the Yes fan who's looking for things to fill in all the gaps. And to me, if I were a Yes fan who's never listened to my YouTube channel, I think listening from the first video and going forward, you see the progression of the band, you see the history of the band, see how things sort of worked itself out and played out. That was sort of my intention of doing everything sort of chronologically, besides organization, is that you can see how the band has grown and evolved over the course of years and decades. And that's where I would start. I would just start with the very first one. And right now, my first video is from 1964, and it's John Anderson with the Warriors. When he plays with he did that video, the "Don't Make Me Blue," and like I said, once I get to 2019, yes, I hope to start filling in like all the proto Yes stuff with, you know, like I said, like Neat Change and Happy Magazine and Bodast and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah,
sort of flesh that out.
Should probably list how they can find that channel.
So if you go to YouTube, all you have to do is Google a search for a Yes Source. There's two channels by that name, but mine is two words, unfortunately. I was hoping to have the double S's like Yes Songs, but it didn't turn out that way. And Yes Source are two words. My blog is judicialsupport.wordpress.com, and on that blog, I like the blog because I have all of the videos linked in a chronological order. You can just scroll right through them, where I don't think YouTube has a very good search function. And everything is right there. And what I do on my blog is I put all the links to every video on it, and then I also put collections up. So I have Live in New York 1997, and that's a link on my blog that's like insular, and you can get all those things. Or, you know, Yes in the Studio for Close to the Edge, that's sort of an insular link on my blog that you can go see it. And so I sort of organize things really well there.
Brilliant. All right. Well, thank you very much indeed, Jim, for coming and talking to us this week.
No, it's my pleasure.
I'll put all the links for those in the show notes for this week's episode as well on yesmusicpodcast.com. But for the moment, Mark and Jim, thank you both very much indeed.
No, thanks. My pleasure. I really appreciate it.
Take care.
Olá, sou o Miguel Falcão, de Coimbra, Portugal. Estão a ouvir o Yes Music Podcast.
Just before we go, here's the patron update for this week. And I'm going to read out the other half of the list. Yes Music Podcast producers are Jeffrey Cresselius, Preston Frazier, VR Hoisington, Bill Govier, and Wayne Hall. And Yes Music Podcast patrons are Aaron Steelman, Joost Maglef, Bob Martellotta, Brian Sullivan, Chris Bandini, Craig Estenes, Dave Owen, David Hayden, Lind, David Pannell, Dave Watkinson, Dem, Doug Curran, Fergus Cubbage, Fred Barringer, Jeff Bailey, Jeffrey Mason, Guy de Rome, Henrik Antonsen, H.B. Peterson, Ian M.B., Jamie McQuinn, Ken Fuller, Jeremy North, Jim, John Cowan, John Holden, John Parry, John Thompson, and Barry Gorski. Also, continued thanks to Robert and David, of course. So thank you very much indeed to all those patrons and the other half. If you'd like to join them in helping to support the show financially and get access to lots of exclusive content and activities, head over to Patreon, patreon.com/yesmusicpodcast, or just click the link on yesmusicpodcast.com. So that's just about all the time we have this week. Thanks so much for listening once again. I do hope we'll be back next week. But in the meantime, do please get involved with the show yourself via the website, Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. On all those platforms, you can find us just at Yes Music Podcast. So until next week, just remember, whatever your progressive rock question, the answer is yes.